Today is Monday, March 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, major turnouts at protests in Russia may have unveiled a strong undercurrent of anti-government feeling. Also ahead, we take you to Iraq, where VOA's Heather Murdoch has been talking with people fleeing the embattled city of Mosul, and a British city seems to have a new way to produce electricity. Is all on today's International Edition. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has appeared in court a day after he and hundreds of other protesters were detained at an anti-corruption rally. Navalny was taken to a Moscow court Monday, hours before the Kremlin publicly called the protest a provocation to violence and accused organizers of paying young people to attend the rallies. Tens of thousands of Russians demonstrated in cities across the country in support of a call by Navalny for accountability among Russia's elite. Joining us from Moscow is VOA's Daniel Scharf. Daniel, what happened to Navalny in his court appearance?
Well, in court today, they sentenced the opposition blogger and opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, to 15 days in jail for resisting police when he was detained yesterday in central Moscow when he tried to show up for this anti-corruption rally that he had called for supporters to attend. He was also fined 20,000 rubles, that's about $350, for organizing what the court said was an illegal demonstration in the center of the Russian capital. Now, Navalny argued back to the court saying that the authorities had not offered specific alternative venues for his demonstration within 3 days of the rally itself. So therefore, according to Russian law, he should be allowed to hold it where he wanted to, which was in central Moscow. Now, the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has argued back saying that's not true. They offered two alternative venues, which the opposition leader rejected. So there's a little bit of back and forth going on. But at the end of the day, the result is Navalny's been put in jail for 15 days and given a small fine, which is a more symbolic fine than anything substantial. But sticking him behind bars for 15 days obviously is sending a signal that Russian authorities were not happy with what he was doing.
What is it that brought out so many thousands of protesters, not only in Moscow, but in cities around the country?
Yeah, this was massive protests in cities all over Russia, more than 80, according to the organizers. And basically, it was sparked by this YouTube video that was released by Navalny's fund against corruption, which investigates corruption among high-level officials, among people connected to the Kremlin. And they released a YouTube video in recent weeks that accused the Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, of having estates in Italy, yachts, you know, very expensive properties, all fraudulently accusing him of very blatant corruption that they linked directly to him through their investigation. So very serious allegations. And essentially, it got a lot of attention in Russia, over 11 million views on YouTube. And after it got so much attention, Navalny said, okay, we need to hit the streets. We need to protest. We need to show authorities that we're serious, that we're sick and tired of corruption. You know, we saw a pretty big turnout across the country, at least in these major cities, showing that there is a fairly large amount of people inside Russia that are not happy with the situation here.
And what's been the reaction from the government so far, beside hauling Navalny into court?
Well, of course, they have called the protesters provocateurs, saying that, you know, these were unauthorized, that they were trying to incite violence. It's been pretty one-sided from authorities. They also accused Navalny, as you mentioned, and his organizers of paying some of the protesters to participate, although they didn't actually produce any evidence or cite any sources for that. And, you know, essentially said that this was a big manipulation meant to cause trouble inside of Russia.
What do you think lies ahead? Will the fact that Navalny has been put behind bars motivate many of these protesters, maybe through social media?
Well, certainly, I don't think this is going to be the end of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The authorities seem to be quite careful in that they go after people who are very close to Navalny. They've jailed his brother. They've gone after his fund against corruption, which authorities raided yesterday. So certainly they're trying to pile pressure on him, but they don't want to make him into too much of a martyr. They've stuck him under house arrest in the past. Now he's got 15 days in jail. They certainly could have come up with something harsher if they really wanted to. But what they don't want to do is create an even bigger following of people who want to see Navalny get even more people out onto the streets. And of course, he's also already announced that he's going to be running for president next year, presumably against President Vladimir Putin, unless the authorities decide to keep him locked up or some of the other pending charges against him. If he does get sentenced to some more jail time. We'll have to see exactly what Navalny does after 15 days when he is presumably going to be released. But he certainly has made it clear in comments to media at the courthouse that he doesn't see this as the end, that, you know, if thousands of people, tens of thousands of people across Russia came out to unauthorized, unsanctioned protests, then, you know, millions were sympathizing and wanting to come out, according to him. If they are able to organize more, then I'm sure he's going to try and do so.
VOA's Daniel Scharf joining us from Moscow here on International Edition. Thanks so much, Daniel. We continue on International Edition with Andrew Palcheski, who's been keeping watch, as he always does, on social media. And Mr. Trump is again trending, eh?
Yes, as he often is. When we were on the show on Friday, I was talked about how there was a lot of social media activity surrounding the vote over the health care bill, a vote that ultimately did not happen because the bill was pulled. And as a result of that now, you have some interesting conversations going on social media. First, you have President Trump coming out saying, "I never called for immediate repeal and replace. It was supposed to be a longer-term plan." And social media and the minds on social media, as quick and good at research as they are, they found all these video clips and spliced them together of Trump saying during the campaign, day one of the presidency, we're going to repeal and replace. We're repealing and replacing this bill. And they spliced together all of these comments after he makes that comment today and says, "Well, I never said immediate repeal and replace." So a little bit of back and forth on that. And then there's a lot of questions about what happens next, particularly with GOP leadership. And this is another interesting Trump tweet. Friday, he tweets out, he says, "Watch Judge Jeanine on Fox News tonight at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
It's, Jeanine Pirro has a show on Fox News. And she starts the show and she immediately calls for Speaker Paul Ryan to step down. So people analyzing this now saying,
"Don't want to give anything away, right?"
Is this Trump? Well, they're asking, is this Trump kind of giving a thinly veiled criticism, saying that Paul Ryan should step down by encouraging people to watch this show? They said, "Oh no, he just is a fan of Jeanine Pirro. He just wanted people to watch the show." It's like trying to read the tea leaves sometimes with the tweets that go out, and just a lot of conversations now going on about what happens from here. Do the Republicans focus on tax reform, or do they try to go back at the health care bill and then the political back and forth? Republicans, a lot of them still standing by Trump, blaming the Democrats for the bill's failure. Democrats saying, "We're not the ones driving the car here."
Democrats are in the minority.
Yes, that's what a lot of Democrats are saying, "We're not the ones in charge. It's all you guys."
Very, very interesting. All we can say basically is what is. Or maybe it's not.
You never know.
Anything else yet?
The other big trending story, Jared Kushner, of course, the president's son-in-law, trending last night because he's going to be heading this kind of SWAT team, Office of Innovation, that's going to look at business solutions to the U.S. government. And then trending today because he said he's going to testify in front of the Intelligence Committee on the Russia links to the Trump campaign. So he's getting a lot of attention as someone who's kind of behind the scenes in the Trump presidency, front and center right now.
Well, and the president also gave his daughter, who is Jared's wife, her own office in the White House, although she doesn't have a title, right?
A lot of questions about that as well, about what exactly she'll be doing and how much access she'll have. But a lot of people trying to look at a silver lining, saying that she might be a more moderating factor on some of the more conservative ideals. She's had some more moderate political viewpoints expressed in the past.
Well, you know, we haven't had a situation like this, at least in my memory, in the White House in a long time. But it happens almost on a daily basis. So we shall see what happens.
And we will report on it as a trend.
You got to hope for the best.
That's all you can do.
Andrew Palshevsky, thanks for being with us here on International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, a Russian court has sentenced opposition leader Alexei Navalny to 15 days in prison, a day after he and hundreds of other protesters were detained at an anti-corruption rally. The U.S. military says the death of civilians in Iraq's northern city of Mosul is a terrible tragedy, and that it is investigating allegations that airstrikes from a U.S.-led coalition killed as many as 100 civilians there earlier this month. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is reiterating the importance of Israeli-American cooperation in the battle against what he called militant Islam in the Middle East. South Korean prosecutors say they want a court to issue a warrant to arrest former President Park Geun-hye on corruption allegations. And the White House confirms that President Trump's son-in-law has volunteered to answer questions before the Senate Intelligence Committee about arranging meetings with the Russian ambassador and other officials. More on these stories and on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Observations made by Mars probes have suggested that the planet once had an abundance of water flowing over its surface. But scientists have been left scratching their heads, wondering how this would be possible, considering the ancient sun was about one-third as warm as today. A popular theory proposes that the ancient Martian atmosphere was rich in carbon dioxide, which created a greenhouse effect that would have warmed the surface enough to allow liquid water to flow on the red planet. Studies suggest that Mars lost its atmosphere about 4 billion years ago. New findings from NASA's Mars Curiosity rover show that sedimentary bedrock from an ancient lake does not contain any carbonates. NASA researchers say this lack of carbonates suggests that the Martian atmosphere could not have held carbon dioxide when water was said to flow on Mars some 3.5 billion years ago. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We continue on International Edition. The U.S. military says the death of civilians in Iraq's northern city of Mosul is a terrible tragedy, and that it is investigating allegations that airstrikes from a U.S.-led coalition killed as many as 100 civilians there earlier this month. The Pentagon has said an initial review showed coalition warplanes did conduct strikes on March 17th at the location corresponding to allegations of civilian casualties in western Mosul's Old City. Iraqi forces with coalition air support are working to regain control of western Mosul from Islamic State fighters who seized the city in mid-2014. Joining us from Erbil is VOA's Heather Murdoch. Heather, you've been in the area for quite a while now and talking with people coming out of Mosul. What are they telling you?
Well, from the beginning, people have had horrific stories about what's going on in Mosul as they come back out and in areas that are now controlled by Iraqi coalition forces. But in the past week, and a week or two, rather, there's been a dramatic uptick in the amount of violence civilians are experiencing. At first, I thought it was just an anomaly that I was meeting people that had 10, 20, 30 family members killed in airstrikes and also in other ways. But now it seems to be, especially in one particular area called New Mosul or Mosul Jadida, it seems to be more the norm. They're getting into the part of Mosul that is the most crowded, and the fighters there are the fiercest because they don't really have anywhere to run anymore. And they have packed civilians into houses and are fighting from rooftops. And then they have holes in the houses so they can fight from a rooftop, run downstairs, go to another house before an airstrike hits. And just to be clear, though, it's not just airstrikes the civilians are complaining about. They are complaining that they are dying from airstrikes, but they're also being executed as they try to flee by Islamic State militants. They're being hit by mortars and car bombs. So it's a whole bunch of things that have turned this area into a disaster zone.
Well, there are all kinds of groups, civilians, humanitarian aid groups, monitoring officials. They're all warning about the possibility of increased civilian casualties. What can be done? What do you see happening there if there is any way out?
Well, at the moment, the Iraqi forces haven't been entirely clear about what they're going to do, but they have. Some have suggested, some commanders have said they're pausing or slowing down, trying to rethink their strategy, because they have from the very beginning said their main goal is to take back Mosul with killing as few civilians as possible. And at this point, it seems almost impossible to know how they can do that. I'm not sure they even know how they can do it. The most disastrous area, as far as I understand it, New Mosul, has been cut off to journalists for the past 3 days. We don't know exactly why, but it's hard to know exactly what they're doing on the ground in that spot because they've blocked us out.
Well, you heard in the introduction, and I'm sure you already know about the Pentagon reaction to this, almost admitting that a U.S. airstrike did take away many lives in that area. Could that have been prevented?
I don't know. I mean, people that were there and the people that saw it happen and the people that their neighbors died in those airstrikes, even they're not sure what should have been done correctly. I mean, they will say, please tell the coalition to stop shooting at houses in Mosul because there's always families underneath the houses. At the same time, they're saying, please let the coalition and Iraqi forces move faster because at this very moment, Islamic State militants are taking people's IDs and forcing them to go back with them. Because the people are wanting to run to the Iraqi forces. So the local people, on one hand, want the airstrikes to stop. On the other hand, they want an Iraqi and coalition victory as soon as possible.
Is there any sense of normal life going on anywhere in that city?
It's sort of a facade. Like, for a while, it seemed like things were going back to normal in a lot of parts. Like, the furthest from the parts of Mosul furthest from the river are starting to look more normal. Like, a lot of the restaurants are open, the small cafes and the shops, and the most successful guy around is the guy that makes the signs because everyone wants new signs to redecorate their businesses. As you go closer to the river, the airstrikes and burnt out buildings are more common than actually operating businesses. But even in the parts that sort of feel safe and sort of feel normal, there's enough violence that every time people start to get used to feeling normal, something else happens, and it starts to feel dangerous and warlike again.
VOA's Heather Murdoch covering this war in Iraq, and she joins us from Erbil. Heather, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATONLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
We continue with International Edition. The massive renewable energy project could change the seascape of the Welsh city of Swansea in coming years. The plan here is to encase the city's lagoon in a horseshoe-shaped causeway that will serve as a giant tidal generator. The four-year project is massive, but if it's approved, would create a long-term, reliable source of clean energy. We got more now from VOA's Kevin Enoch.
The 9.5-kilometer horseshoe would literally ring the harbor of Swansea. Once in place, the huge tides on the English coast will be spinning turbines and creating huge amounts of energy.
We open the gates in the tidal lagoon, we let the water through the turbines, and we generate electricity. It's five Olympic swimming pools worth of electricity every second, and that generates enough electricity for 155,000 homes per year.
The core of the project is this massive generator that is equipped with more than 20 6-meter-high turbines that spin when the tide goes in and the tide goes out, four times a day. That is energy the designers say residents can count on, unlike wind and solar, which can be weather-dependent.
So that's the biggest difference between tidal power and, say, wind and solar power, is that the wind is intermittent and you get the sun during the day. With the tides, you always have certain electricity at certain times of the day, and then that's staggered at shifts by 40 minutes every day.
The causeway will be created by slowly building it up with giant sandbags. And on top of that, a 9-kilometer causeway for running, biking, and sightseeing that proponents say will last hundreds of years.
Once we build the breakwater wall, it's going to be there for the next 120 years. When we put the turbines in, they're there for the next 120 years. So what's quite interesting about this piece of infrastructure is it's intergenerational. It'll last for the next five generations, producing power throughout its lifetime, working with the rhythm of the tides.
The project will cost an estimated $1.6 billion and take 4 years to build. But it will go a long way towards replacing aging nuclear plants and help the United Kingdom meet its clean energy goals. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
That's going to wrap it up for us here today in Washington. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin, Engineer Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In its latest report on human rights conditions in Iran, the U.S. State Department noted that in 2016, there were severe restrictions on the Iranian people's civil liberties, including the freedoms of assembly, association, speech, religion, and the press. In addition, the State Department reported abuse of due process, as well as politically motivated violence and repression, disappearances, and limitation on citizens' ability to choose their government peacefully through free and fair elections. The report also noted arbitrary arrest, denial of fair public trial, and the lack of independent judiciary. Recent news from human rights monitors confirmed that the new year has not brought an end to such abuses in Iran. In February, Amnesty International reported that Iranian doctor and Swedish resident Ahmad Reza Jalali, who was arrested and imprisoned last year on a visit to Tehran to attend a conference on disaster medicine, was brought before a revolutionary court without his lawyer and informed that he was accused of espionage, a charge that is punishable by death. In March, according to Human Rights Watch, intelligence authorities ramped up detentions of peaceful government critics, arresting journalists Hengame Shahidi, Ehsan Mozandarani, and Murad Sagafi. HRW also noted the arrest of administrators who managed channels within Telegram. The Center for Human Rights in Iran has also noted that in the run-up to the presidential elections in May, the intelligence ministry has increased the arrests of individuals for their peaceful activism and personal beliefs, including civil rights activist Farzaneh Jalili, teenage ethnic Arab environmentalist Mohammed Kab Eomer, and film director Soleh Deldam. Most recently, multiple news outlets have reported that Faezeh Hashemi, women's rights activist and daughter of the late President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, has been sentenced to 6 months in prison for spreading lies against the judiciary. In the preface to the State Department's country reports on human rights, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy. The United States calls on all governments, including the government of Iran, to respect the fundamental human rights of their citizens, thereby forming, in Secretary Tillerson's words, the foundation of stable, secure, and functioning societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.